From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, deadly attacks in Syria, more building occupations by pro-Russia insurgents in eastern Ukraine, getting people help for the people affected by that violence in South Sudan, plus experts watching MERS outbreak for global menace. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. At least 50 people have been killed. It happened in a bomb and mortar attacks. Two cities in Syria affected and homes. Two car bombs exploded in a mainly Alawite neighborhood, killing 36. Meanwhile, in the capital, Damascus, mortar shells killed at least 14 people, injured more than 85 others in the Ashahur section. Police say some of the shells landed near a religious school and that some of the pupils were among the casualties. Syria's government blamed the Damascus attack on terrorists, as they put it, in terms used for the rebels fighting to oust President Bashar al-Assad. Also Tuesday, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons said it will send a team to Syria to investigate recent allegations the government used chlorine gas in an attack on a rebel area this month. In a statement, the watchdog said the Syrian government has agreed to the mission and will provide security in areas under its control. Meantime, 35 experts on international law and humanitarian issues have signed an open letter calling for the United Nations to do more to deliver aid to millions of people in Syria who desperately need it. VOA's Al Pessin in London is following the story.
The open letter published in European newspapers says the United Nations is too concerned about violating Syria's sovereignty and should do more to force the Damascus government to allow humanitarian aid into the country. The experts say the legal commitment to Syria's sovereignty is outweighed by an international doctrine called the responsibility to protect. The concept is that if states do not protect their citizens from mass killing and other crimes against humanity, the international community has a responsibility to do so. Professor Stephen Chan of the University of London is one of the signatories.
I just think that the humanitarian situation in Syria has become so desperate that the time for legal caution has passed.
The letter acknowledges that taking a more aggressive approach, such as trying to send in relief convoys without permission, could be dangerous. But Professor Chan says armed convoys have been used before in other conflicts. He says it may be time to try that in Syria.
The Syrian government would be taking a huge risk in terms of what little respect it still has if it were to attack a humanitarian convoy.
Chan says the letter writers want to pressure the Syrian government and rebel groups to allow the aid to pass. But he says, more importantly, the United Nations needs to authorize a more aggressive humanitarian approach.
The key objective is the United Nations, but also within the United Nations, pressure on the Security Council, and particularly on countries like Russia, to facilitate what is intended here in our letter very, very much as a humanitarian exercise.
The United Nations says more than 9 million people in Syria are in urgent need of assistance, and 3.5 million of them are in hard-to-reach areas. The authors do not expect one letter to change that, but they hope it will add to the pressure on Syria and its supporters to do something to ease the suffering. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Also in the news, demonstrators seeking more regional power stormed an administration building in Luhansk, Ukraine on Tuesday. Luhansk is one of the largest cities in eastern Ukraine. Insurgents have seized control of police stations and other government buildings in at least 10 towns and cities across the region. Demonstrators who stormed the building in Luhansk, like those elsewhere in the east, seek a referendum on granting greater authority to Ukraine's regions.
Народна власть, яка сидить в СБУ, наші герої, защитники.
One mass demonstrator told the Associated Press the People's Government in Luhansk has proposed that the Kiev authorities hold a peaceful referendum. And at a news conference in Kiev on Tuesday, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt said it's been suggested to the interim government in Kiev that they carefully deal with the pro-Russia insurgents occupying buildings in eastern Ukraine.
Our advice would be to encourage the government to continue on the course that it has been pursuing, of seeking a strategy to cordon these cities, to use their security forces and the army if necessary, to ensure that weapons, money, instability are not trafficked in and out of these cities, but not to engage in the forceful clearing of these buildings.
Ambassador Pyatt also spoke about possible U.S. response should Russian troops cross the border into eastern Ukraine.
Russian troops crossing Ukraine's borders would be a major escalation and would draw an inevitable sharp reaction from the United States. And I think that's understood by everybody. It would be a dramatically unfortunate development, which I think would produce only the most tragic consequences.
Russia has massed tens of thousands of troops in areas near the Ukrainian border, feeding concerns that Moscow aims to use unrest in the east as a pretext for an invasion. Russia has accused the United States and NATO of what it called provocative statements on the crisis in Ukraine, unfolding alongside a NATO military buildup in Eastern Europe. Meantime, diplomatic efforts are continuing to seek the release of seven observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe who are being held by pro-Russian gunmen in eastern Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell has our report.
Transport planes brought about 130 U.S. Army paratroopers to Estonia on Monday, part of a NATO show of force in Eastern Europe. Several NATO members have sent warplanes and ships to the region. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said Tuesday the military buildup was accompanied by provocative statements about the need to contain Russia. NATO commander in Europe, General Adrian Bradshaw, insists the deployment is appropriate.
Our judgment is that the actions that we've taken at the moment are proportionate and appropriate to the changed security dynamic that we face. It gives a very clear indication of NATO commitment to the region.
Russia is also building up its forces in the region. Two naval vessels have returned to join Moscow's Black Sea Fleet based in Crimea, the region Russia annexed from Ukraine last month. The highest tensions since the Cold War have prompted accusations of covert military intervention in Ukraine from both Russia and the West. Seven observers from the OSCE were seized by pro-Russian gunmen last week in the flashpoint city of Slovyansk, accused of being NATO spies. Five Ukrainian soldiers were also taken hostage. The observers were paraded in front of television cameras Sunday. The leader of the mission, German Army Colonel Axel Schneider, said they were in Ukraine strictly in line with their OSCE mandate.
And I clearly state, the Vienna document diplomats come to the nation without arms, without ammunition. We are not fighters. We are diplomats in uniform.
The militants want to exchange the OSCE captives for pro-Russian activists held by the Ukrainian government. Among the hostages are three German soldiers and one interpreter. Berlin's defense minister Ursula von der Leyen visited their home barracks Monday.
Es ist das erste Mal, dass in einer solchen
She told reporters, this is the first time that inspectors were apprehended during such a verification mission of the OSCE. She added, that's why it is all the more important to make clear that we will not be bullied and this will not jeopardize further missions. Quite the contrary. The Vienna-based OSCE was created during the Cold War as a forum between East and West. Observer missions often include army personnel, but their role is strictly diplomatic, says Andrew Foxall of the Henry Jackson Society, a Britain-based policy analyst organisation.
To evaluate events on the ground, to monitor how the situation is developing, and then to make suggestions or policies for how the situation might then develop.
The OSCE's 57 members include Russia. Western countries say it is up to Moscow to put more pressure on the pro-Russian gunmen to release all the hostages. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And you can keep up to date on what's happening in Ukraine, plus the world's reaction by going to our website, voanews.com.
Each week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world.
She was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist. And she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
Paramilitary soldiers patrolled the streets of Srinagar on Tuesday ahead of general elections in Indian-controlled parts of the disputed Kashmir region later today. Authorities have detained more than 600 Kashmiri residents ahead of the polls opening. Pradeep Kumar Singh is in charge of the Central Reserve Police Force in Srinagar.
That is to prevent any violence, agitations or violence or stone pelting on the day of polling. So these preventive arrests are aimed at having a peaceful polling.
Rebel and separatist politicians have urged Kashmiris to boycott the election, which they call a military exercise by overbearing New Delhi. Officials at polling stations in the region have expressed concerns about a lack of security arrangements following violent protests at an earlier round of voting last week. Voting is being held over several days so security forces can better guard the polls. Indian Kashmir elects only 6 members of India's 543-seat parliament. Results are expected on May 16th. Microsoft founder and philanthropist Bill Gates wrote an article this week in the Chinese state-run People's Daily. In it, he called on China's wealthy elite to donate more to the poor. Gates said he's confident that investing in the poor will bring rewards, calling it an exciting a success in business and more rewarding, he says. Gates, who co-chairs the $40 billion Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which operates in more than 100 countries, said if we help the poor to rid themselves of illnesses and problems, the entire world can achieve sustainable development. The Arun Research Institute's 2014 Global Rich List includes 358 billionaires in China, second only to the United States. Meantime, the 2013 World Charity Ranking of 135 countries listed China as 133rd in the percentage of people who donate money or volunteer or help a stranger. However, China ranked first in the number of people, 373 million, who helped a stranger in any given month. And at least one major Chinese company, internet firm Alibaba, announced on Friday it has set up a charitable trust that could be worth $3 billion. Co-founders Jack Ma and Zhou Tsai say the trust will be funded by share options they own, representing about 2% of the company's equity. Trust is being set up as Alibaba prepares for a highly anticipated initial public offering, or an IPO, that some analysts say could value the company at more than $150 billion. David Zweig is director of the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology Center on China's Transnational Relations. Speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty, he said he was surprised the People's Daily allowed Gates to write his appeal.
Philanthropy really is a societal movement. And so on the one hand, you would think that CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, would not be so keen in encouraging individuals to get involved in this kind of stuff. But poverty alleviation is a really big issue in China. The state has done quite well on it. You know, it's taken, maybe 500 million people out of poverty. But it feels that it's time for this new rich class that's emerged to start to make serious donations. And so, you know, whether they approach Bill Gates himself or he volunteered to do it, I think it's a good thing.
He says China has many successful entrepreneurs and business people. I hope that more people of insight will put their talents to work to improve the lives of poor people in China. The timing of this is interesting given that the founders of Alibaba announced last Friday they're setting up a charitable trust that could be valued up to $3 billion.
Well, one of the things that's interesting when you think about the China case is I just came back from India. And in India, I was interviewing returned entrepreneurs, people who had come back from overseas. And just about everybody I interviewed in some ways was engaged in some kind of charitable action. They'd set up an NGO. They were working for an NGO. They really had a sense that they had to give something back to their country, but also knew that their country India didn't have a lot of money and wasn't putting a lot of money into poverty alleviation. Now, here in China, I think people for a long time have relied on the state to do all this stuff. And the state's been, as I said, pretty successful in poverty alleviation. But it's something that just individuals have not gotten very involved in. So this action by Alibaba, I think, is a great thing. There's a lot of people in, you know, there's a lot of rich people in China, friends of mine I know, too, who have sort of said, well, what am I going to do now? You know, I've made all this money. What should I do with it? And I think it's really important that they find this kind of activity.
Do you expect Alibaba's example to be followed in China?
Well, I think it sets a good example for other people. As I said, people in China who have made a lot of money are looking for some kind of contribution that they can make, especially if they came back from overseas. And they've seen, to a certain extent, what's gone on overseas in terms of the importance of philanthropy. They should be mobilizable for doing this. The first time we saw this kind of engagement by Chinese citizens was the Sichuan earthquake, when people drove from Shanghai, you know, with cars full of supplies, and they were driving, you know, four-wheel drive SUVs. These were rich people coming in to try and help the poor in the devastated areas. So that was really a time when civil society, as we like to call it, sort of really woke up. So it's been awake, but it hasn't been very active, and so hopefully they'll follow the way of Alibaba.
Zweig says in China, philanthropy occurs at the local level, the village level. He says there is a long tradition of investing in local schools, although there is no tradition of what he calls trans-regional investment in people who one who doesn't know, you don't know. He says it will be interesting to see how Chinese respond to the Alibaba challenge.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palkov.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
UN Refugee Agency says it is racing to provide essential supplies for hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese displaced by the war before the rains make roads impassable. Nearly 1 million South Sudanese have become internally displaced since fighting between government and opposition forces broke out 4 months ago. They are spread across 175 makeshift and organized sites, with the largest number in Upper Nile State. UNHCR spokesperson Fatoumata Lejunkaba.
It's not everywhere that we can access all the time. The lines of fighting move constantly. The displaced themselves move constantly. So even if they receive assistance in one place and they are forced again to flee because of new fighting, they find themselves with nothing. It's overcrowded for most of them, including, of course, at the UN bases. The sites are not proper at all.
Lejun Kaba tells VOA the agency's priority is to relocate 23,000 South Sudanese in White Nile State away from where they presently are staying.
Already, we've had visits there to the relocation areas, and it seems like people will be willing to go. It's important because very soon we won't be able to access the Kilo 10 site. So most likely people will move and relocate.
Lejun Kaba says it's already raining in White Nile State, but the heaviest rains usually begin in May. Meanwhile, the UNHCR and its partners are also providing aid to tens of thousands of South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia. She says aid agencies are expanding accommodations for nearly 100,000 refugees in the Gambela region in the west of the country. She says land is being cleared for up to 30,000 people. She says the camp is expected to open early next month. UN Security Council has lifted a ban on diamond exports from the Ivory Coast and also moved to ease an arms embargo. The council on Tuesday adopted a resolution lifting the diamond embargo that was put in place in 2005 in the wake of the country's civil war. The measure also relaxes the arms embargo so Ivorian security forces can acquire small-caliber weapons. Ivory Coast UN ambassador hailed the vote. He said the end of the diamond export ban recognizes that his country has fully satisfied minimum conditions of the Kimberley process. That's the system to ensure so-called conflict diamonds do not enter world markets. The ambassador also said that the council's decision to ease weapons restrictions recognized the country's urgent need to train and equip its security forces. Experts are watching a viral outbreak in the Middle East for signs that it could become a global menace. VOA's Steve Barragona takes a look at Middle East respiratory syndrome, what it is, what it does, and why it's grabbing headlines.
First, the bad news from epidemiologist David Swerdlow. He heads the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's response to Middle East respiratory syndrome, or MERS.
30% to 40% of people who get it have died. It's caused illness in multiple countries. The virus clearly spreads from person to person and is severe, and there's no treatment or vaccine. So we are concerned.
The MERS virus first appeared in September of 2012. Saudi Arabia has seen the most cases. It's a member of the coronavirus family, which includes germs that cause the common cold, as well as severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. That disease popped up in southern China in 2003, infected about 8,000 people in 29 countries, and killed about 800 before it was contained. Here's a bit of good news. MERS does not spread as well as SARS did, according to Amish Adalja with the Infectious Diseases Society of America. He spoke to VOA by Skype.
With SARS, we saw much more human transmissibility, and we also saw individuals who we called super spreaders, people who disproportionately spread the virus more than anybody else and were really responsible for how the virus made its way all around the world.
There are no MERS super spreaders, Adalja says, at least not yet. The most recent data from the World Health Organization reports 261 MERS infections, including 93 deaths. Other case tallies are higher and put the death toll over 100. A spike in cases in Saudi Arabia beginning last week has raised worries among health experts that the virus has mutated into a more spreadable form. That would be a danger sign, but the CDC's David Swerdlow says German researchers have examined DNA from some of the new Saudi cases.
The information that they've shown suggests that there has not been any significant change in the virus.
That's good news, but Swerdlow says researchers need more data to be sure. And he adds they still do not know why the case count spiked.
Some of this could be seasonality. Some of it could be better surveillance. Some of it could be just that there's a large outbreak ongoing in some healthcare facilities, perhaps.
Many of the victims have been healthcare workers who come in close contact with sick patients. And many of the sickest patients have had other health problems, such as kidney disease, cancer, or diabetes. It's not yet clear where MERS came from originally, but camels are the lead suspect. Unfortunately, there's a lot about MERS that scientists do not know. What they do know, says IDSA's Amish Adalja, are lessons that SARS drove home.
The world is a small place, that borders don't mean anything, and that the total health security of the globe is really tied up in identifying these threats as quickly as possible and then trying to stop them in their tracks.
That's why health officials around the world are keeping a close eye on MERS. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Owner of the Los Angeles Clippers of the U.S. National Basketball Association has been banned from the league for life because of racist remarks he made about African Americans in an audio recording. In addition, Donald Sterling is being fined $2.5 million, the maximum allowed under NBA rules. On the recording, a male voice asked the woman, who is of Latino and African heritage, not to post photos of African Americans on her Instagram page and not to bring African Americans to his basketball games. The Clippers are now competing in the NBA playoffs, and a number of the team's advertisers have begun canceling or suspending their sponsorships of the team. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is coming your way shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On April 30th, 1789, George Washington took the oath of office to become the first president of the United States. The ceremony took place on the balcony of Federal Hall on Wall Street in New York City. In 1803, the United States purchased the Louisiana Territory from France for $15 million, more than doubling the size of the nation. In 1888, the deadliest hailstorm on record killed at least 230 people and destroyed much of the farming town of Moradabad in northern India. In 1927, Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford became the first celebrities to leave their footprints in concrete at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood. Grauman was not the sole owner of the place, even though it bears only his name. His business partners in the venture were none other than, you guessed it, Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks. In 1939, the U.S. broadcaster NBC began regularly scheduled television programs in New York City. NBC televised President Franklin D. Roosevelt's address for the opening of the New York World's Fair. On this day in 1975, the war in Vietnam ended as South Vietnam announced its unconditional surrender to North Vietnamese forces. The surrender came shortly after the United States withdrew its support for the government in Saigon. In 1993, the European Organization for Nuclear Research near Geneva, Switzerland, announced it would make the World Wide Web available to the general public for free with no fees required for its use. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, China's status as a major power is already solidified. Built on its growing economic ties across the globe, and particularly across the Asia-Pacific region. U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel said recently when he addressed military officers of the Chinese People's Liberation Army and students at China's National Defense University in Beijing. To preserve the stable security environment that has enabled this historic economic development, the United States believes in maintaining a rules-based order built on freedom of navigation and overflight, liberal trade and economic policies that foster widely shared prosperity for all, halting the proliferation of dangerous and destabilizing weapons of mass destruction, deterring aggression, and clear, consistent, and peaceful methods of resolving disputes consistent with international law. Mr. Hagel added that both the United States and China have a responsibility to address new and enduring regional security challenges. As a nation's power and prosperity grows, so does its responsibilities, Mr. Hagel said. And whether the 21st century is one marked by progress, security, and prosperity will depend greatly on how China and other leading Asia-Pacific powers meet their responsibilities to uphold a rules-based order. We must work together in partnership with all the nations of the region and develop and build on a new model of relations, Secretary Hagel emphasized. Developing a new model of military-to-military relations will require a shared understanding of the regional security order we seek and the responsibilities we have to uphold it. The new model of military-to-military relations should proceed on three tracks, Secretary Hagel said. First, maintaining sustained and substantive dialogue. Second, forging concrete, practical cooperation where the two countries' interests converge. And third, working to manage competition and differences through openness and communication. America's rebalancing to the Asia-Pacific is about ensuring that America's presence and engagement, including our relationship with China, keeps pace with the Asia-Pacific's rapidly evolving economic, diplomatic, and security environment, Secretary Hagel said. It will require bold leadership that seeks to deepen practical cooperation in areas of shared interest, while constructively managing differences through open dialogue and candor.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.